content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 16th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Clinton's narrowing lead over Trump. What happened? Hillary Clinton's poll lead over Donald Trump continued to shrink this week as both presidential campaigns kicked into high gear for the nine-week post-Labor Day sprint to Election Day. The Real Clear Politics national poll average put Clinton's head-to-head lead over Trump at just over 3 points, 46 to 43, down from 6 points 2 weeks earlier. But several polls produced even better news for Trump, with a four-way CNN-ORC poll of likely voters showing him ahead by 2 points, 45 to 43, and a Reuters IPSOS poll finding him with a one-point lead, a nine-point swing in just 2 weeks. Clinton still holds an advantage in the swing states, however. In Real Clear Politics four-way averages, she's ahead in nine of the 11 key battleground races, including Pennsylvania by 6, Florida 2, and Ohio 3 points. Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, said the tightening of national polls showed that voters were disturbed by revelations regarding the former Secretary of State's private email server and the overlap of her official duties at state and her role at the Clinton Foundation. Hillary Clinton is having a hard time being accepted as a truthful and honest candidate, she said. Both campaigns had eventful weeks. Trump received mixed reviews for refusing to significantly soften his hardline stance on immigration, while Clinton came under further scrutiny after the FBI released a trove of documents from its probe into her home email server. Labor Day also marked the official start of the battle to control Congress. Although the GOP is widely expected to retain control of the House, Democrats need gain only 5 Senate seats to reclaim the upper chamber. The closest races will likely be in Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire. What the editorial said. Labor Day is when most Americans start to get down to the serious business of choosing a president, said the Washington Times. Clinton's poll slump suggests Trump's bluntly stated message, secure our borders, put America first, and rebuild the economy, is resonating with a growing number of voters. Previously skeptical Republicans are becoming more comfortable with Trump as their nominee, despite his many blunders, while questions over Clinton's greed and trustworthiness are gathering relevance and momentum. Conservatives, Trump does not deserve your vote, said the Dallas Morning News. The newspaper has not endorsed a Democrat for 75 years, but Trump is no Republican and certainly no conservative, and is not qualified to serve as president. He doesn't believe in free markets and individual liberty, and has an authoritarian streak that should horrify limited government advocates. His foreign policy is incoherent and includes proposals to cozy up to Russian dictator Vladimir Putin and abandon our NATO allies. Clinton has made mistakes and displayed bad judgment, but she is the only serious candidate on the presidential ballot. Trump is betting we are all chumps, said the Washington Post. How else to explain his assumption he can win without sharing basic information? He has refused to release his health records, his tax returns, or virtually any detailed policy proposals, even though he would be the oldest president ever elected, has based his entire campaign on his business success, and has no record in public office. He's taking the American people for fools. what the columnist said. I'm getting a sick, sinking feeling about this election, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. In their desperation to appear neutral, major media organizations are paying remarkably little attention to Trump's many scandals, yet insist anything Clinton does, especially concerning the Clinton Foundation, must be corrupt. Note to journalists, criticism of Trump doesn't have to be balanced out by unfairly suggesting that his opponent is equally awful. Actually, reporters are just doing their job, said Glenn Greenwald and TheIntercept.com. Only Democrat partisans see nothing fishy about the Clintons' pioneering merger of massive private wealth and political power. Just because Trump is a bigotry-exploiting demagogue doesn't entitle Clinton to waltz into the Oval Office free of aggressive journalistic scrutiny. To listen to conventional wisdom, Clinton practically cannot lose the presidential election, said Douglas Schoen in the Wall Street Journal. Yet Trump is ahead, tied, or trailing, but within the margin of error in almost all the most recent polls. The race is tightening not because he's a stronger candidate, but because Clinton is becoming less and less popular. Her favorability levels have dropped to record lows. Hillary could be blowing it, said Glenn Thrush in Politico.com. She has made her campaign almost exclusively about Trump's unfitness for the White House, but hasn't connected to voters in a personal way or made a positive, uplifting case for why voters should support her. Attacking Trump is not enough. Clinton remains the big favorite to win the election, said Nate Silver in 538.com. But Democrats are seriously mistaken if they think her leads in the swing states will protect her in the Electoral College. State polls have basically ebbed and flowed with her national numbers. If the race continues to tighten nationally, her leads in the swing states will evaporate, and Clinton could be in serious trouble. What next? Both candidates have serious work to do, said Adam Nagurmi in the New York Times. Trump needs to focus all his attention and attacks on Clinton and resist the urge to double down when criticized for saying something offensive. As for Clinton, she has to avoid complacency and work hard to regain the public's trust. The presidential debates will also be crucial. With both candidates so widely disliked, this contest has a volatility rarely seen at this stage of a campaign. As many as 10% of voters remain undecided in some polls, said Stephen Shepard in Politico.com, and others are leaning toward third-party candidates. That means this race is likely to be a roller coaster right up to November the 8th. Controversy of the week, Trump doubling down on immigration. So much for the pivot, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. After Donald Trump's visit to Mexico last week, where he did his best to sound sober and statesmanlike in a meeting with President Enrique Peña Nieto, it looked as though Trump's promised softening on immigration had finally arrived. Later that day, however, the old Trump resurfaced with a vengeance in Phoenix. At a raucous rally for supporters, the GOP nominee reiterated his pledge that our southern border will be secured by an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful wall, while also promising to hire 5,000 new Border Patrol agents and create a special deportation task force. On day one of his presidency, Trump shouted, his administration will start deporting illegal immigrants who have committed crimes in this country, a number Trump wildly inflated to 2 million. Once these criminal aliens are gone, as well as an estimated 4.5 million who have outstayed their visas, Trump will apparently turn his attention to the remaining 6 million illegal immigrants who may or may not be given a path to legalization. Trump's Phoenix speech sounded threatening, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. But beneath the bombast, this was actually one of the more substantive and sensible speeches on immigration we've ever heard from a presidential nominee. Prioritizing border security and the deportation of criminal aliens makes a lot of sense, as does Trump's insistence that U.S. immigration policy serve the interests of America and its workers, not the welfare of foreigners. Trump's earlier promises to deport all 11.5 million illegal immigrants were never more than fantasy, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. Out of political necessity, he has found his way to the only immigration solution that makes any sense. Secure the borders first, aggressively enforce current immigration law to get rid of the bad guys, and only then offer legalization to those who meet our terms. You're trying to make Trump sound reasonable, said Timothy Egan in NYTimes.com. His speech was actually one of the darkest visions of the American experience that any major party nominee has ever given. Trump not only denigrated and threatened the lawn cutters, sheetrock hangers, fruit pickers, or nannies we see in every community, he called for cutting back on legal immigration, admitting only those who meet his standards for merit, skill, and proficiency. That would have ruled out most of the Irish, Italian, Scandinavian, and Jewish immigrants who came to the U.S. over the past 150 years out of desperation and hope for a better life. During his trip to Mexico, Trump proved he's a coward, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. What kind of straight-talking tough guy calls Mexicans terrific and showers them with compliments when he's within their borders, then breaks out the harsh rhetoric the minute he's safely back in the U.S.? That's the behavior of a candidate with a fatal flaw, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. When Trump first announced he was softening his harsh immigration stance and flew to Mexico to meet with Peña Nieto, it made Democrats very nervous. Would he finally give wavering Republican-leaning centrist voters the assurances they need to take a chance on Trump? But then at the rally in Arizona, he couldn't help but throw red meat to his angry, roaring acolytes. With a golden opportunity to show he can be presidential, Trump decided he'd rather look tough and strong, which he thinks means belligerent and bigoted. If Donald Trump loses in November, it will be because he simply lacks the self-discipline to reach voters beyond his base. It was a good week for intolerance. After Ohio's Kent State University opened a country's first entirely gluten-free campus cafeteria because officials didn't want students with celiac disease to feel singled out. It was a good week for coded messages after Brazilian researchers revealed that Renaissance painter Michelangelo secretly included dozens of hidden images of female reproductive organs and pagan fertility symbols in painting the Sistine Chapel to show his irritation with the Catholic Church's male-dominated culture. And it was a good week for having a taco after Latinos for Trump founder Marco Gutierrez inspired widespread hilarity by warning that if the border isn't walled off, you're going to have taco trucks on every corner. That would require 3.2 million taco trucks, the Washington Post estimated, or about 300 times the number of Starbucks stores. But it was a bad week for men in black after ISIS leaders banned referees from soccer matches in its Syrian stronghold because they uphold the rules of FIFA and not Sharia. It was a bad week for landmarks after a group of vandals at an Oregon state park deliberately destroyed an iconic sandstone formation known as the Duckbill, telling a witness their friend had recently broken his leg climbing on it and that it was a safety hazard. And it was a bad week for civilization as we know it. After experts in robotics warned that by the year 2050, humans will be having sex with cyborgs and may prefer them to other humans. Sex bots would always be available and could never say no, said researcher Joel Snell of Kirkwood College. Robotic sex may become addictive. And while we're here, Zika bill fails in Congress. As Congress returned from a seven-week recess, Senate Democrats this week blocked a $1.1 billion emergency funding bill to fight the Zika virus, citing provisions that Republicans had attached that would cut funding for Planned Parenthood. Lawmakers have been under pressure to address the spread of the mosquito-borne virus, which can cause devastating birth defects. Mosquitoes carrying the virus have already infected at least 56 people in southern Florida. Health officials say they are concerned that the virus could continue to spread in the southeastern U.S., where peak mosquito season does not end until November. Lawmakers now expect the anti-Zika funding to become part of stopgap measures that Congress must pass by September 30th to avoid a government shutdown. On the briefing page, the Philippines populist strongman. President Rodrigo Duterte has encouraged a wave of vigilante killings across his nation. Why is he so popular? What's Duterte doing? Since he took office at the end of June, President Rodrigo Duterte has unleashed the police and vigilante hit squads against suspected drug dealers. "My order is shoot to kill you," he said. "I don't care about human rights. You'd better believe me." In just 2 months, more than 1,900 people have been summarily executed in the streets. Most of them were suspected low-level drug dealers, but some were bystanders caught in the crossfire. The youngest was a five-year-old. Duterte, 71, has not only thumbed his nose at the Philippines' rule of law, he has also threatened those who criticize his tactics. He's fired thousands of government workers, saying they were all corrupt, and pledged to fill the jobs with his own loyalists. He has already insulted the U.S. ambassador and warned President Obama not to question the wave of killings, adding, "Son of a bitch, I will swear at you." As a result, Obama canceled a meeting with Duterte planned for this week. How did he come to power? For 22 years, he was mayor of Davao City in Mindanao, a Philippine island plagued by a long-running Islamic insurgency, a trash-talking populist who says he hates career politicians. Duterte was known in Davao City for his blatant womanizing and for his success in fighting crime. When he took office in 1988, Davao was the murder capital of the Philippines, but now it is one of the country's safer cities. He accomplished that feat by living up to his nickname, the Punisher. Death squads loosely aligned with the city's authorities roamed the streets on bicycles, shooting suspected drug dealers on sight. Hundreds of people were killed, but the crime rate dropped, and Duterte was elected seven times. How did he become president? The campaign this spring was bitter. Outgoing president Benigno Aquino, who had presided over 5 years of economic growth, endorsed Wharton-educated investment banker Manuel Roxas to succeed him. But Duterte painted the little-known Roxas as part of the corrupt establishment and said that the Philippines under Aquino was becoming a narco state. He pointed to evidence that Mexico's fearsome Sinaloa cartel was using the Philippines as a transit shipment point and bemoaned his country's rampant abuse of methamphetamines marketed there mixed with caffeine and known as shabu. The drug has devastated many Manila neighborhoods where some of the local police are in the pay of drug gangs. An alarmed Aquino told voters to remember how Hitler came to power. But Duterte won a five-way race in a landslide with nearly 40% of the votes to Roxas' 23%. How are people responding? The most recent poll showing a 91% approval rating was completed just a week after he took office, so it doesn't reflect the wave of killings that followed. But anecdotal evidence indicates that Duterte's kill-them-all strategy is both effective and popular. Fearing for their lives, more than 500,000 suspected drug dealers and users have surrendered to police in the past few weeks. The political mainstream, though, is horrified by the street shootings. This is like anarchy, said Senator Antonio Trillanes. What is his policy toward the U.S.? Duterte resents the Philippines' history as a former U.S. colony, occupied from 1898 to 1946. A self-described socialist, he wears his anti-Americanism like a badge of honor, pointedly meeting with envoys from Japan and China before those from the U.S. He called U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg this gay ambassador, son of a whore, after Goldberg criticized him for his recent comments on the rape and murder of an Australian missionary, which occurred while Duterte was mayor of Davao. "I was angry because she was raped, that's one thing," Duterte said. "But she was so beautiful, the mayor should have been first. What a waste." He has brushed aside U.S. criticism of the killings on his watch, saying, "Why are you Americans killing black people there, shooting them down, when they are already on the ground?" Will he abandon the alliance? No. Duterte says he wants closer economic ties with China, the country's second largest trading partner, after Japan and before the U.S. Yet the U.S. is still the Philippines' largest source of foreign investment, and Duterte doesn't want to jeopardize that inflow. He has also conceded that the U.S. is his country's only major military ally at a time when China is pressing claims to islands in the South China Sea that the Philippines considers its own. Last month, Duterte said he would abide by a defense pact signed by his predecessor that allows U.S. forces to operate from Philippine territory. But he's also made it clear he doesn't feel that he owes the U.S. anything in return for its military protection. "I am no American puppet," he said this week. "I am the president of a sovereign country, and I am not answerable to anyone except the Filipino people." How Duterte's resentment started. Duterte has said he still feels hatred for the U.S. for a 2002 incident in Davao while he was mayor. An American treasure hunter named Michael Mehring, who sometimes joked he was with the CIA, was charged with possession of explosives after a metal box in his hotel room blew up, tearing one of his legs off. Philippine officials said FBI officials snatched Mehring from the hospital in the night and flew him out of the country. Duterte was furious, saying Mehring was a criminal suspect, possibly a spy or a terrorist, and that the U.S. had no right to violate Philippine sovereignty by removing him. Mehring had frequently traveled to areas where Islamic separatists were active, possibly as part of a U.S. campaign against the Abu Sayyaf, a rebel gang of kidnappers operating from the jungle that recently swore allegiance to ISIS. In the Philippines, it's widely believed Mehring was conducting bombings that could be blamed on this rebel group to increase pressure on the Philippine government to permit greater U.S. involvement. Mehring died in 2012 without ever explaining why he was in the Philippines and carrying a bomb. And we'll move on to a few of the columns, two this week from the U.S. The first titled, The Immorality of Animal Research. As a scientist who spent decades conducting research on monkeys, said John Gluck, I once believed that intentionally harming animals was justified by what we learned. But after witnessing the terrible suffering we inflicted, I now believe animal research is immoral. In fact, we need to examine whether we should stop the research that scientists are still conducting on 70,000 laboratory primates in the U.S. In my own work, we separated young monkeys from their families and others of their kind, putting them in isolated soundproof cages that were lit 24 hours a day. We then measured how their potential complex and intellectual lives unraveled under these awful conditions, in effect driving them insane. As we observed these intelligent primates suffer, I began to see them as individuals with personalities and feelings, not just objects yielding data, and it became harder and harder for me to argue that the importance of my work always outweighed the pain I caused. Besides, what we learned about animals in cages had limited relevance to mental illness in people. In recent decades, we have banned research that causes harm to humans, even if it produces useful information. There is no ethical argument that justifies not doing the same for animals. Cutting off aid to Israel. I support Israel, which is why I don't support U.S. aid to Israel, said Jeff Jacoby. How is that possible? For decades, the prevailing Zionist view has been that military aid from Washington, which now amounts to $3.1 billion a year, is the most tangible manifestation of American support and a cornerstone of the U.S.-Israel alliance. In reality, the Jewish state boasts a booming economy and doesn't need our charity. Plus, all that American largesse comes with strings attached and might actually be making Israel weaker. The U.S. stipulates that Jerusalem must spend 75% of each year's assistance in the U.S., essentially subsidizing American defense contractors instead of bolstering its own thriving arms industry. What's more, numerous Israeli military experts argue that an over-reliance on U.S.-made jets and missile systems may be skewing their country's defense focus toward air power at the expense of ground strategies crucial to fighting terrorists. The aid also enables the U.S. to exert pressure on Israeli decision-making, thus complicating our alliance. Israel is healthy enough to stand on its own two feet, and it should be a matter of pride for it to do so. From Germany, far right embraces a culture war. The populists are on the march, said Hannah Beitzer. The Alternative for Germany party, or AfD, this week shot ahead of Chancellor Angela Merkel's center-right Christian Democrats in local elections in the eastern state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. The AfD took second place behind the center-left Social Democrats, with the Christian Democrats suffering their worst-ever result in the state. Pundits tried to rationalize the upset by pointing to economic factors, the state's high unemployment and low salaries. But the truth is staring us all in the face. This is a culture war. Just look at the slogans on AfD supporters' banners, such as Lying Press and USA War Criminal Number One. Look at the billboards plastered all over the state telling people to vote AfD so that Germany won't be destroyed. This is a rebellion against modern German politics and modern life itself. It is anti-American, anti-foreigner, and anti-feminist. When AfD leaders talk about our children, they mean the white ethnic German children of straight married couples, not the children of single mothers and absolutely not refugee children. They long for the Germany of 50 years ago, when men were men, women were women, and non-Germans were just guest workers with no intention of staying. And we'll move on to the last word, our in-depth article, this week titled, When Hillary Was President. Hillary Clinton's political life began in 1968 when she was elected Wellesley College's student body president. How she dealt with the tumult of that era, said journalist Michael Kruse, reveals a lot about her temperament. In the fall of 1968, in the wake of one of the most violent, volatile summers in American history, as young people clamored for an end to the war in Vietnam and for greater racial justice and women's rights, the student body president at Wellesley College stood in front of the incoming freshman class and talked to them about the merits of conversation and committees. Although we, too, have had our demonstrations, not yet 21-year-old Hillary Rodham, the future Hillary Clinton, told the approximately 400 newest students of the country's preeminent women's college, change here is usually a product of discussion in the decision-making process. She had just spent much of her summer in Washington, interning on Capitol Hill. At a historic juncture of acute anti-establishment fervor, she told them to trust the system. Progress at Wellesley, she explained, often results through action taken by the Senate of the College Government Association. The idea of President Hillary in 2016 is thrilling for some and scary to others. But for one small group, students at Wellesley in 1968-1969, it is a phenomenon they have already lived through. And while the student presidency has only so much in common with the job she's bidding for now, what she did in elective office as a junior and senior in college turned out to be remarkably predictive of the kind of politician she has become. Clinton has called the 4 years she spent on the secluded campus in this staid suburb of Boston among the most exhilarating and informative of my life. The most popular storyline from her college career is her shift from right to left on the ideological spectrum, but lots of her peers made that same transition. Much more telling is the way she ended up occupying an almost singular role in the school's political life. During a period of social upheaval, she was the most prominent intermediary between her increasingly radicalized fellow students and a change-resistant faculty and administration. Hillary tended always to be what I will call a consensus person, classmate Connie Hunk Shapiro told me. The college's archives, including minutes of the student government meetings and coverage in the student newspaper, as well as interviews with professors and more than a dozen of her classmates and contemporaries, reveal a strikingly clear picture of the political personality that has defined the Democratic presidential nominee ever since. Centrist, cautious, respectful of authority, progressive but never at the expense of maintaining access to the seats of power. While some more disaffected students saw her as overly tame for the time, way too mainstream, talking the language of the administration, co-opted. One of them, who's now dead, said in 1999, many of her classmates considered her more pragmatic style important and useful in the tumultuous atmosphere. As she climbed the ranks of college government from class representative to the student senate, as a sophomore to chairman of the Ville Juniors organization, and finally to student body president, she favored teach-ins over sit-ins, symposia over sign-waving. She led successful initiatives that looked somewhat small-bore now, but felt like big deals then, persuading the college to eliminate antiquated curfew regulations, getting students more latitude in choosing courses. She was also supportive of a group of black students who pressured the administration to agree to admit more black students, hire more black professors, institute a black studies program, and end segregated room assignments. And she did these things not only by listening to the concerns of fellow students, but also by forging relationships with professors, deans, and a college president whom those same students saw as a stodgy obstacle to change. She was very pragmatic in terms of how do you approach the college administration, said one of those professors, Alan Schechter, who was her political science thesis advisor. The academic year that had started with her speech to the freshmen ended with a different speech on the last day of May, the much more written about one that she gave at graduation. It was sufficiently noteworthy to land her in the pages of Life magazine, tapped as a bold voice of a new generation. The graduation speech offered a largely progressive message, but she delivered it in language that was far from incendiary. More a manifesto of moderation than a revolutionary's battle cry. She talked about constructive protest. She noted a conservative strain that goes through a lot of the new left. And she invoked a poem by T.S. Eliot, East Coker. She had excerpted the poem, in fact, at the beginning of the 92-page thesis she had turned in earlier that month. About Saul Alinsky, the countercultural community organizer who became a punching bag of conservative commentators. The thrust of the thesis was what Rodham viewed as the inherent limits of radical activism, and among the many resonant lines of Eliot's work, one stands out for its applicability to the ambitious young woman who is speaking in the graduation gown. So here I am, in the middle way. I just couldn't get her to reveal anything, said Laura Grosch, a fellow Wellesley student who spent 3 one-hour sessions painting Rodham's portrait. Grosch was a junior and an art history major. She's now a professional artist living in North Carolina. And Rodham was a freshman. They lived in the same Davis Hall dorm. Grosch wanted the practice and some extra money. She charged $30 and Rodham volunteered. Over the course of the sessions, Grosch tried through informal conversation to tease out of Rodham some essential truth to inform her painting, something poetic. But it was a challenge. Rodham talked a lot about politics, conservative politics, Grosch recalled. At the time, though, what was there to reveal? Rodham wasn't so sure of herself. She was from the middle of the country, Park Ridge, Illinois, outside of Chicago. She was a churchgoer, a Methodist. Her mother was a Democrat, but quiet about it, and preached to her children an even keel by using a carpenter's level as a visual aid. You try to keep that bubble in the center, she would say. But her stern taskmaster father, on the other hand, was resolutely a Republican. And by the spring of her freshman year, his daughter was the gung-ho head of Wellesley's Young Republican Organization. She worked to recruit student workers for state and local Republican campaigns. In the spring of her sophomore year, Rodham gave a speech from the steps of the main academic building to a crowd of some 350 people about the need for fewer dictated curriculum requirements. "If we get this going, maybe we'll see a change before we graduate," she announced, one of the first public signals of her patient, incremental disposition. One of the organizers of the event, Leslie Pickering Francis, wanted her to participate in part because she was known on campus as a conservative, she told me, a student who could help show the administration that this was an idea with broad backing. Less than 3 months later, having relinquished her affiliation with the Young Republicans, Rodham joined friends at a hippie get-together on the banks of the Charles River in Cambridge, a vast be-in, as the Boston Globe put it. Rodham sat still as Grosch painted a flower on her chin. Rodham's junior year in particular was a turning point. In the fall, she took a new course, Sociology 220, Urban Society, which was unusual for Wellesley not only because of its larger size, 40 to 50 students, according to Steve London, the instructor, but also because of its content. The term at the time was the urban crisis, but it was unavoidably a class about race relations, London told me. These were young women who had this real thirst for knowledge about what was going on in the country at the time. Rodham also became increasingly anti-war, which put her at odds with her father. She still self-identified as a moderate Republican, but struggled to square this personal evolution with her political upbringing. In a letter to her youth pastor from Park Ridge, she posed the question, "Can one be a mind conservative and a heart liberal?" She started to settle somewhere in the middle. Friends went into Harvard Square or down to New York or Washington to attend aggressive tear gas tents, marches, and rallies. They don't remember Rodham joining them. Hillary, Shapiro said, was by no means radical. What she was a budding policy wonk, one who wanted to be student body president. Her role as the chair of the Ville Juniors, which made her one of the more prominent upperclassmen on campus to new freshmen, allowed her to meet, talk with, and be known by students who now were potential voters in campus elections. Rodham didn't rest. She spent 3 weeks walking the halls of dorms asking for votes. Her platform, such as it was, leaned heavily on a faith in Robert's Rules of Order. In committees, as president, she wrote in a statement about her candidacy in the Wellesley News on February 15, 1968, "I would like to explore the feasibility of having students as advisory members of committees directly concerning us, such as the Library Policy Committee." Rodham's election surprised no one but maybe herself. She gushed to London. She said, "Can you believe it?" The sociology professor told me. Those were her exact words. "Can you believe I was elected president of the student government?" That spring, when Rodham was a kind of president-elect, the campus grew increasingly anxious. Anti-war sentiment had surged to a point where even Wellesley, never close to a radical hotbed like Berkeley or Ann Arbor or Columbia, seemed like its own brand of tinderbox. "I stayed up all night," she would say more than two decades later to a writer from the Alumni magazine, "to talk students out of staging a Vietnam War protest that would embarrass our college." Almost half a century later, in the archives in the campus library, the typed-out minutes of the meetings Rodham ran as college government president show an interesting, unmistakable pattern. Rodham is mentioned actually relatively infrequently. She opens the meetings, and she usually closes them. The rest of the time, it's almost always other people doing the talking. To the young women, professors, and administrators who had come to know her through her first 3 years on campus, this was not a surprise. She was a capable orator, many of them told me, but was much more comfortable as a listener. I think she was very good at bringing people along, explaining why process works, why it allows your voice to be heard, said Eleanor Dean L.D. Eckerson, another classmate and a lifelong friend. As interesting as her absence in the minutes of the meetings is her presence, when she talked, what she talked about, and how. In a meeting in October, for example, members of a civil rights group called Ethos seethed at what they saw was as a school official's lack of urgency in implementing changes they had agreed to after a threatened hunger strike. One dean, according to the minutes, talked of the problems that could arise in filling the background gaps for students admitted with inadequate preparation. The stance and the implication infuriated Ethos leaders. "We will not be raped," read an ethos-signed letter in the news. Rodham's response was considerably more measured. Miss Rodham, read the minutes, expressed the hope that Wellesley community as a whole would become more involved with the college and would work for the ideas expressed above. The take in the news: Rodham remarked that it is because of the possibility and the potential of the college that we are so frustrated. Throughout that year, and especially in the second semester, the future 2016 Democratic nominee worked on her thesis about Alinsky, the radical activist. Today, more than her commencement speech, those 92 pages read like a capstone of her own intellectual and ideological evolution at Wellesley. Alinsky's conclusion that the ventilation of hostilities is healthy in certain situations is valid, but across the board, social catharsis cannot be prescribed, she wrote. Catharsis has a way of perpetuating itself so that it becomes an end in itself. She continued, "This society seems to be in a transition period, caught between conflict and consensus. It was clear where this 21-year-old stood. As our two societies, the establishment, the anti-establishment, move further apart, contrived conflict serves to exacerbate the polarization." Later, in her first memoir, Hillary Rodham Clinton would make it plain. "Alinsky believed you could change the system only from the outside," she wrote in Living History. "I didn't." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico magazine. On the Health and Science page, the Milky Way's dark twin. Astronomers have spotted a dark twin of the Milky Way, a discovery that blows apart their already patchy understanding of dark matter. Located 300 million light years from Earth, Dragonfly 44 is about the same size as our own galaxy, but contains a tiny fraction of its stars. Only about 0.1% of the newly discovered galaxy is made up of ordinary, visible matter like stars, 100 times less than the Milky Way. The rest apparently consists of dark matter, the elusive, mysterious substance that astrophysicists believe makes up 80% of the matter in the universe. Scientists have never actually seen dark matter. The existence is predicated on the theory that without its gravitational effect, stars and other celestial objects would drift apart rather than clump together in galaxies. Dragonfly 44 isn't the first dark galaxy astronomers have discovered, but it's the only one incomparable in size to the Milky Way. "We thought we had sort of figured out what the relationship is between galaxies and dark matter," the study's lead author, Peter van Dokkum, tells CNN.com. This discovery turns that on its head. It means we don't understand, kind of fundamentally, how galaxy formation works. Physicists hope to discover other dark galaxies to increase their understanding of one of the most puzzling building blocks of the universe. How your dog understands you. Man's best friend may understand us better than we thought. Groundbreaking new research has found that dogs process words and intonation using separate parts of the brain, the same way humans do, reports the Washington Post. Scientists trained 13 dogs of various breeds to lie still in an MRI machine. The pooches then listen to a trainer reciting positive phrases such as "good dog," as well as meaningless ones like "however," in both a neutral tone and a happy attaboy tone. The scans showed that the dogs processed the meaningful words with the left side of their brain, the same hemisphere humans use to process language, and intonation with the right side. Furthermore, the canine's dopamine reward centers, which respond to things like food or being petted, weren't activated by meaningless phrases spoken in a positive tone of voice or by encouraging words spoken in a flat tone. Dogs not only tell apart what we say and how we say it, says Attila and Endix, the study's lead researcher, but they can also combine the two for a correct interpretation of what those words really mean. On the Talking Points page, Trump's rise. Are Democrats to blame? Did Democrats cry wolf? Asked Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Political commentators on both the left and right have been warning for months that Donald Trump's bigotry, nativism, and volatile personality make him a unique threat to the country. Yet the tightness of the polls suggests many voters aren't convinced. Maybe it's because they've heard it all before. 4 years ago, many liberals denounced the mild-mannered Republican nominee Mitt Romney as a blood-sucking capitalist vampire whose indictment of Obamacare was ipso facto proof of his racism. In 2008, John McCain was portrayed as a combustible hothead who couldn't be allowed anywhere near the nuclear codes. When hyperbolic invective like this is deployed against decent politicians, how do you convince Republican voters that this year's nominee truly poses a much greater, graver danger? Liberals have often portrayed opponents as not just wrong, but evil, said Pascal Emmanuel Gobry in TheWeek.com. So as voters hear them hyperventilating about Trump, they're asking, why should we trust you this time? Liberals may be accused of many sins, but enabling Trump is not one of them, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. We have been warning for decades that Republicans were using racial coding to appeal to whites and descending into unhinged, knee-jerk, anti-intellectual reaction. They can't blame us just because we've been proved right. It's pretty rich of conservatives to claim Republicans were blinded to Trump's inadequacies by extreme rhetoric, said Jonathan Bernstein in BloombergView.com. The right accused President Clinton of being a drug-running murderer and a likely communist, attacked John Kerry's service record in Vietnam, and declined for years to disown racist allegations that President Obama wasn't a U.S. citizen. It's Republicans who are responsible for Trump. Voters aren't actually ignoring Trump's deficiencies, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. He's the most unpopular presidential candidate in history. 44% of Americans think he is a racist, and 59% that his campaign appeals to bigotry. Trump is competitive only because we live in a highly partisan country in which major party nominees are almost guaranteed 40% of the vote, and because Hillary Clinton is almost as unpopular as he is. In another universe with even a modestly more popular Democratic candidate, the race would be long over. Here's one of the It Wasn't All Bad shorts that I thought you might enjoy. Robert Marin worked for nearly 50 years at the University of New Hampshire's library, where his colleagues knew him as a frugal man. He drove a 92 Plymouth, rarely bought new clothes or went out, and ate frozen dinners. His coworkers finally discovered what Marin, who died last year at 77, had been doing with his money when the university last week announced that the librarian had left his estate, all $4 million of it, to the school. Marin's life savings will now be used to fund scholarships and renovations. The feeling around here, said school spokeswoman Erica Mance, has been just kind of awe. And just a few other short pieces. Let's see. Donald Trump's campaign has 7 policy proposals listed on his website, totaling 9,000 words. Hillary Clinton's campaign has 65 policy fact sheets with detailed proposals totaling 112,735 words. When it touched down last week as a Category 1 storm, Hurricane Hermine was the first hurricane to hit Florida in 11 years. Over the past 12 years, the number of Americans who say they use marijuana on a daily or near-daily basis has jumped from 3.9 million to 8.4 million, or from 1.9% of the U.S. population to 3.5%, according to a new study in Lancet Psychiatry. On the poll watch, 73% of U.S. adults read at least one book over the past year, up from 72% in 2015. 65% read a print book, 28% read an e-book, and 14% listened to an audiobook. And we'll finish up with a quote, this from Jay Leno. He says, "If God wanted us to vote, he would have given us candidates." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.